Acts 17, verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now, what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by hands, and he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the times set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, for he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead." When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Right, well, good morning, everybody. Thank you. People are here. There's a lot of microphones up here. I'm just going to move them around. Let me just pray before we start. Lord, help me to be clear in speaking your word this morning. And may it be support to those that need it and challenge to those that need that. Amen. So, my name's Steve, and I'm one of the church members here. I know a lot of you know me, some of you may not. In my work, I travel a lot for training. That's the reason I wasn't around last weekend for all the various events for Flockstock and things, which sound great, so well done on those. I was away in Belfast last weekend. And there's a couple of, there's a few issues when you have a sort of travelling training role. The main issue I have, of course, is getting the flip chart and the overhead lockers in the planes, which never quite fits. But the other big challenge is you go somewhere else and the culture's a bit different. And the way in which you do things and the way in which you express things needs to change. I can actually remember the very first time, I think, I ran a training course in Denmark. And we're about near the start, and a typical thing, I was taught to do at the start of training courses was set some ground rules. So, you know, wrote ground rules at the top of a flip chart and said, OK, what are our ground rules going to be? And I'm thinking about things like, you know, let's switch off our phones, let's not talk over each other, let's listen, that sort of thing. I can see the teachers smiling at me. They obviously do this every day. Anyway, so I suggested this and a hand shoots up and somebody says, in Denmark, we don't like rules. I said, oh, OK. So, thinking on my feet, I said, okay, what about mottos? Do you do mottos? And they kind of looked at each other. I think sensing a trick question. So the mottos, yeah, okay, yeah, we do mottos. So I said, okay, well, for this course, if we had a motto, what would your motto be for the course? Okay, so they chatted a little bit. And they said, okay, we've decided on our motto. It would be honesty and respect. I said, okay, that sounds good. So what sort of things does it mean to show honesty and respect? And they said, oh, well, turn off your phones, don't talk over one another. But, you know, it's, you know, the way you connect over different cultures is interesting. And what we've got here is a time in Paul's journeys where he suddenly crosses a border and he moves into a different culture with a group of people that have a different way of looking at the world and a different way of looking at things. And he is bringing the same message about a message about Jesus. And what we're going to explore is a little bit about how he's done that, how he's connected with their culture. And then I want to take the message that he spoke to the ancient Greek culture, and then address that to our culture today. Because Paul walked their streets, and he saw something interesting, and he spoke into that. And what we're going to move to this morning is to think about, what if he walked our streets today? What would he see? And would his message actually be any different, or would it be the same? To get us going, I'm going to do a quick recap on where he is in all these journeys, because we've sort of missed out a week. If we go back 2 weeks, for those of you that were here, there was something important in the reading that we went through quite quickly, so I just want to kind of recap, just in case you missed it, because Paul had been on his travels, and he was approximately here. When this happened, if I can find it, that's why you should write down all the verses, shouldn't you? Can't find it, so I can't read it out. But essentially what happens is he is travelling through, he's about to turn south down towards Turkey, and he has a dream. And God gives him a dream about a man from Macedonia who is searching and trying to find Jesus. And that the Paul message takes from this dream is, I have to now change plans and I have to cross the sea and go to Greece. So in a dream he is told to head over to Greece and take the word over there, and he goes in obedience. Just in his journeys, if you struggle to kind of separate out all the different journeys Paul does, here's the easy way, okay? It's like a three-course meal. So for starter, he has Turkey, okay? That was his first journey, that's his starter. So Turkey for starters. For main course, it's meze, because second and third journeys he takes in Greece. And that's two separate journeys he makes that trip. It's slightly different routes, the arrows aren't geographically exactly accurate, but it's a meze for main course. And what does he have for dessert? Something Italian, tiramisu. Okay, so final journey is to Italy, and I think some people seem to see that as two separate or one journey. I don't really know, but there's certainly three different steps. So where he is right now, he's had his start, he's done Turkey, that's been covered. He's on his second journey through Turkey, and now for the first time, he goes to Greece. He visits a couple of cities on his way, but where we want to focus is Athens. So he ends up in Athens, and this is where he makes the speech that we just heard. Now, I think it's a useful bit of background. We've got to understand how the Greeks saw the world a little bit differently to the Jews. So in one picture, here's Greek worldview. We've all heard about the Greek gods, and you might have read Percy Jackson books or things like that. So the Greeks and these philosophers that we heard about talking would see the world in this view. We have the earth, ruled by humans. That's our domain, although you'd occasionally get gods visiting and dropping in and out, but the earth was the domain run by humans. Part of the earth would be the underworld, ruled by various gods. And then you had the heavens, which was the realm of the gods, and there were many gods, and the constellations being the representation of those gods in the heavens. So you have these domains, earth, the heavens, and under the earth, if you like. And it's important because when you hear what Paul says about God later on, some of the words he's using is referencing this worldview. So you have to get that in your head and imagine you see the world in these three chunks, because that's the Greek view. And that was different to the Jewish view of things. So we know they had that worldview. We also know they loved a debate. So in verse 21 it said, all the Athenians and foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. They were philosophers, discussers. They loved a great debate. And we heard about two particular schools of thought in the passage. So Caroline mentioned there were Epicureans and there were Stoics. So just to put that in our terms, the Epicureans, they essentially believed that pleasure is God. They were quite hedonistic. They would pursue leisure, try to spend their time doing fun things. Their view was that if you live a life of leisure, you become free from pain and anxiety. They worshipped pleasure. The Stoics, probably more the boring group to hang around with, I think, in comparison, they believed that knowledge was God. They just pursued wisdom. If you can know everything about everything, you become wise, then that is free from anxiety and pain. So they worship different things. I think if they were around today, the Stoics would be watching Eggheads on a Wednesday afternoon, and the Epicureans would be watching Love Island. I mean, that's what we had there. That's the competing viewpoints we had. So Paul's coming in with a different view. And he clearly has an immediate impact because he ends up at the Areopagus, which was a place translated, we'd call that Mars Hill, I guess. It's Areopagus, as in Ares, the god of Mars. It was a place that used to be used as a courtroom. It was probably just used for general debating. But he attracted enough interest that they gave him a platform where he makes this speech. And I just want to read out, again, a couple of sections and draw us to the final, one of the kind of closing phrases that Paul comes to in his speech. So he starts off by saying, "Men of Athens," this is verse 22 if you're following, "I see in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship is something unknown to you, I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands." What's different about Paul's view? Firstly, one thing is saying there's a Lord of all of this. The gods just aren't in the heavens. There's a God who created and is the Lord of everything, including the earth and the stuff underneath it and everything around it. There is one God who is above all. That was the different view that he was professing. There's something else that's different about it, and for this we need to come to what I think is the key phrase in his talk. So I'm going to scoot on to verse 28, where Paul says, "For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring." Now, when I read this, he said, "as some of your own poets have said," I thought, so I wonder what he's referring to then. He's quoting somebody else. These aren't Paul's words. He's quoting something back at them from their own philosophy. So, after a bit of digging around, he's quoting this. So this is a work called The Phenomena by a Greek philosopher called Aratus. And actually, as you find out a bit more about Aratus, you can understand why Paul might have known about him and might be quoting him, because Aratus studied in Tarsus, where Paul was born. So they have a common background. And this work, The Phenomena, which would have been very popular at the time, was a poem. And this is an English translation of the Greek poem. And the section Paul is quoting is from the opening sequence of this thing called the Phenomena. What the Phenomena is overall is it's basically a description of the constellations. It's an understanding of the Greek gods who rule in the heavens. And Paul chooses it and quotes the opening section from it. I'm going to read, and bear in mind, this is an English translation of the original Greek poem. The person that's translated it has made it rhyme in English, because it's poetry to poetry. So we've got translation issues, because it might not be a word-for-word translation of the Greek, because they're trying to make it poetic as well. But if I read it, you will get the gist of what Paul is quoting here. So this is Aratus's first paragraph. And he says, "Let us begin from Jove." Jove being the name for the father of the gods. So the Greeks would interpret that as Zeus. The Romans would interpret it as Jupiter. "Let us begin from Jove. Let every mortal raise his grateful voice to tune Jove's endless praise. Jove fills the heaven, the earth, the sea, the air. We feel his spirit moving here and everywhere. And we his offspring are. He, ever good, daily provides for man his daily food. Ordains the seasons by his signs on high, studding with gems of light the azure canopy. What time with plough and spade to break the soil, that plenteous stores may bless the reaper's toil. What time to plant and prune the vine he shows, and hangs the purple cluster on its boughs. To him, the first, the last, all homage yield, our Father, wonderful, our help, our shield." So that was Aratus, a Greek philosopher, describing his view of the fathership of the gods. And Paul chooses to quote that back at the Greeks. The point Paul is making here is that Aratus was quite controversial as a Greek philosopher, because many of the Greeks believed the constellations were the gods. And the whole point of that work that Aratus put together was to say, actually, the constellations, they're a man-made interpretation of things. You have created an understanding of these gods, and we've made those ourselves, but there is something real behind it. There is a fathership, there is a creation force at work. They would have probably interpreted as Zeus at the time, and the Romans would have interpreted as Jupiter, but that was the point that he was making. And Paul is saying, actually, Aratus kind of got it right. There is something else there is something beyond it. And the point is, it's not man-made. You have made gods to fill the gaps that you have in your lives, when actually there's something real out there. And life is not about God creation, to find something and make something that you want to worship. It should be a journey of seeking and discovering the true nature of the real God. That's the controversial point he's making. It's the difference between making gods and seeking God. And he says that very clearly in verse 27, which, as I've read it a lot in preparing this, I love as a verse now. I'll read 26 and 27. "From one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live." Then implied question here is, why did he do this? Why did God create mankind? God did this so that people would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and maybe even find him, though he is not far from each one of us. I like that. If you're looking for a kind of purpose to life, our purpose is seeking. That's a comfort to me, because, you know, even as a Christian, having been a Christian for a lot of years, you know, sometimes I still feel quite incomplete about things. I think there's a song. It's used in one of those terrible Jim Carrey movies, unfortunately, but it's a good song, which uses the lyric, "There's a God-shaped hole in all of us, and the restless soul is searching." It's a song by the band called Plum. "There's a God-shaped hole in all of us, and a restless soul is searching." And I heard that quite young. And I thought, when I become a Christian, then the God-shaped hole's going to go. And actually, I don't think it has. There's still a hole. There's still stuff in my life that feels incomplete. I don't think I've found all the answers. And maybe you're sat there and you have. But it's a comfort to read this and go, you know what? We were meant to seek, but to keep on seeking the real God, not to make gods, not to give up and make gods to fill the gaps. And that's what Paul was telling the Greeks that they had done. And they made a lot of gods. In fact, this has just opened at the British Museum. There's an exhibition on living with the gods, which is I haven't been to see, but I just happened to come across that yesterday, and I thought it was relevant to the talk. So Paul was saying, you know, essentially, you've missed it. You've turned gods and religion into a human enterprise. You've put yourself at the center rather than seeking to try to find the real one. So what about us today? So what if this is Paul's message to the Greeks? My big question today is, have things changed? If Paul walked our streets now, what would he see? Have we stopped creating gods to follow the true one? Or have we made our own? So this is my interpretation of what I think Paul would write if instead of walking the streets of ancient Athens, he walked the kind of modern streets of London. This is my pantheon of the modern gods. These are the six gods who I think we've created and I think who failed us. I want to tell you a little about each one of them. And then we're going to talk a bit about... I want you to reflect as we go through about the extent, you know, in your lives, the lives of your families and friends, whether we have drifted towards worshipping these modern gods. And let me say before I go into this that some of these things that we're going to talk about are good things, but they're not gods. And often the easiest idols to have are things that are good things. It's easy to spot an idol that's an evil thing and a wrong thing, but it's harder to spot the idols that are good things, but they creep in and we start to worship them. So what's the first one? So this is Dosh, the god of wealth. I've named them, obviously. I've tried to give them Greek-sounding names. So Dosh, the god of wealth. And this is what I think Paul would write. The temples to Dosh are the biggest and most glorious in the empire, it seems. Some are called banks, others shops. The high priests are called economists, and they are paid tribute for predicting the future. In some places, you can't see the heavens because temples to Dosh fill the whole skyline. I don't know what you think of car adverts. Does anyone like car adverts? They slightly bemuse me because, you know, I watch them and I never seem to find out anything about the car. You get no information there. Is it big? Is it small? Is it, you know, how fast does it go? You know, what are the features? They don't cover any of that, do they? It's usually just, you know, great soundtrack, really nice visuals of that car driving through an empty road in Scotland. I just think, you know, there's a reason why the roads in Scotland are empty. But the point is that, you know, that it's image. They're selling us a lifestyle. They're selling us a dream. And we buy dreams. And I think the followers of Dosh will feel that, you know, the next purchase is going to change their life. We're going to get fulfillment from possessing things. But Dosh doesn't just rule by temptation. Dosh rules by fear as well. The fear that if we anger the gods, if we anger the banking gods and the markets, that, you know, the temples to Dosh will move away to other countries and that the economy will suffer. So there's fear. Dosh rules by fear and Dosh rules by temptation. Dosh has many followers. The second god I think Paul would be intrigued by is the god Commute, the god of hard work. And yeah, the worshippers of Commute gather every morning in these incredible moving temples where they sit in silence, pondering the god, and then they scatter the temple with small sacrifices, usually scarves and mobile phones and umbrellas, that are gathered in by the temple acolytes later and redistributed. There are rewards with Commute. Faithful followers are rewarded with promotions, and then we all live in fear of the great downsizing every few years where Commute claims his own. Then, of course, there's the followers of Commute who will spend their day staring at screens, usually to commune with the gods. And the thing is, it's easy, you know, work is an easy thing to worship. And as I said before, work is a good thing, but it's not God. It fills a lot of holes in our lives. It will give us a sense of meaning, a sense of fulfillment, a sense of purpose. And I see this a huge amount in my work, because it's incredible to me how I coach a lot of people, and a lot of the core issues I see people have in the workplace stems from an insecurity. It's an insecurity of identity. And the problem is, some people, this whole sense of identity is wrapped up with their work. And the problem with that is, if you then start having a bad time at work, and things go wrong, or you're under pressure, or you start to doubt your ability as a trainer, or a nurse, or a teacher, or whatever you do, does that shake the whole foundation of who you are? And the followers of Commute would be shaken by that. Who am I then if I'm not good at my job, or if I lose my job? That's when you know it's become a god for you, when you have those senses, sorts of worries. Very tempting to follow Commute. Remember, you can love your work, but your work won't love you, probably. I doubt it will be your colleagues who will be at your bedside if you're ill, and if they are, that's probably some sort of harassment. Okay. Third, Kardashia, a goddess of popularity. Now, Kardashia is often not worshipped alone. There are some minor deities as well that are often in the temples of Kardashia that I've listed up there. You know, this is not just, you know, worshipping beauty, but this is status. This is, I need to be liked. I need to be loved by others and get affirmation. Followers of Kardashia are obsessed by the question, you know, what do other people say about me? We care about that. It's at the root of our being. Whereas the root question we should be asking is, what does God say about me? What does God feel about me? Kardashia is a shallow god. You will gain followers and you will lose them very, very quickly. Let's move on. I think he would notice Lycra as well, the god of eternal youth. I think there's a modern day obsession. So I'm going to sort of talk as a middle-aged man now here. I learned a couple of new terms while thinking about this. So there's an acronym MAMIL, M-A-M-I-L, which stands for Middle-Aged Man in Lycra, apparently. And that's where I got the image from. That's Bob. I thought it looked a bit like Bob when you blurred it out. It's not Bob. Can you see it? It's a pleasure, Bob. And the term middle essence. Middle essence is the phrase for middle-aged men, particularly, that are trying to sort of relive their adolescence. You know, they'll say, you know, fetch me the Lycra and point me at the triathlon and that sort of thing. Or let's join a youth band. But when a few weeks ago, when Emily was... She gone out here? She's out with her kids, isn't she? When she was talking about the 20s and 30s work, and she was covering the age group, and she started counting up, I started to feel genuine hope. Because she said, you know, 20s and 30s, up to 39, and then she said, to be honest, if you're 40, and I'm 43, right, and I'm going, keep going. She said, if you're 41 or 42, I'm like, I'm nearly there. And then she stopped. I was like, oh, I'm a year short. But I had this genuine hope that I would be counted. I mean, you know, I'm going to skip your bungee jumping trip or whatever it is you're going to do and not embarrass myself. But there was a genuine feeling there of wanting to sort of rediscover youth. And, you know, as I think about, you know, when Paul said, you know, you're very religious about the things you do. You know, we get religious about our work. We get religious about our finances and our pensions. And I think some people get religious about their gym and their health and their beauty regime and things like that. These are good things, but they're not God. Two more gods. Then we'll see what we make of all this for ourselves. There's Saga, the god of leisure. So, where do I go with this? My mum took us on a cruise about a month, was it a month ago? Something like that. She was 70th birthday, so she decided she was going to take the whole family on a three-day cruise. I'd never been on anything like that before, and never will again, by the way. And I think one of the highlights was Tom hearing about the 70s and 80s disco night, coming back disappointed after 10 minutes, saying, I thought that related to the type of music. They joke about cruises that it's the newlyweds, the nearly deads, and the overfeds, and it's definitely true. Sorry if there's lovers of cruises here, but the point is, it's easy to worship leisure, that becomes the purpose of your life, that you're living for the next holiday, and you're idolizing rest and the good things that come with this. Again, rest is good. But it's not God. Saga is the god of giving up, or the god of the easy option. Because, Jesus never promised it would be easy. We took some of the youth to Soul Survivor at Watford last night. They do a Saturday night sort of youth celebration every month. And the guy speaking there referred to a verse I wanted to find this morning, because he was talking about perseverance. And he used the verse from Hebrews 12, which said, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame. And his point was, you know what, if something's easy, you don't have to have perseverance. You only need perseverance if it's tough. Jesus said you would need perseverance and he'll be with you. And that's because there are challenges. So the God of leisure is where we know there are challenges, but we've decided not to face them. We've hidden ourselves away. It's our world. And if we see needs in it, we have to be the people that step up and deal with that. And I think that links us with the last of the gods, which I've called Habitat. The goddess of comfort and security. The followers of Habitat build their nests and hide away. And, it's easy to see why. You know, we've got political strife. We've got two adolescents in charge of world powers abusing each other on Twitter. We've got Brexit uncertainty. There's negativity, I think, these days towards a Christian view in some of our workplaces. We may even experience that, some of us in our families. And it's easy to switch it off and hide away. Rest is good, comfort is good, but they're not God. So I think Paul would see a similar picture. I think he would look around and he would see temples to other gods, the gyms, the banks, the shops. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, who do we worship? To close, I want to give you four questions to think about. And I think these are the tests about whether these things have leaked into your life to the point where you are worshipping them. I think the things we worship will be characterized by you devote most of your time, energy, and resources to it. What is the thing that exhausts you? And where do you expend all your energy? Second thing is, you dream about it. Do you have that dream of winning the lottery? Are you imagining, is your brain imagining that is going to be the answer to all your problems? Three would be, its absence stresses you. When that thing goes away, you need it back, like an addiction. And fourthly, you would immediately resist anything that threatens it. You have that defensive reaction that goes, I can't do without that, and you will justify needing it back in your life. They're the hints that maybe something has become an idol for you. What we're going to do now is sort of, I'm going to pray a little. We're going to have a time of worship. But what I want to do is, we don't do this very often here, but I think this is an appropriate time to do it. As I was preparing this, sometimes I will, you know, ache and think about a message for quite a long time before it starts to come together. This was just there. I have a strong feeling that this is God's word for this church, and it's a word for us right now. Maybe it's just for one person here, I don't know, or maybe it's for many. The number doesn't matter. But I believe there's at least one person here who feels that one or more of these gods has a hold on them, and they're aware of that, and they don't know how to let go. So what we're going to do, the band will start playing quietly in a bit. We're going to sing some songs. You can either stay in your seat and you can sing, or you can pray. It's up to you. You can stand or you can sit. But if you know there is something you need to deal with and something you want to let go of, as a sign to God that you want to let go of that, I want you to come and sit on the front row. Okay, it's empty, fortunately. Come and sit on the front row. There are a few people around, and they've got badges on who are prayer ministry people, and they will come and they'll pray with you. And you can be specific or you can be not specific. They'll probably ask you, what do you want to pray for? And you can just say, just pray for me, and not be specific if you want. Or if you want to give them some detail and say, this is what I'm struggling with, then they'll pray into that situation. That's totally up to you. Okay? But as these songs play, if there's something you just want to say to God, just to signal to God, I don't know how, but I want to let go of it. And this is me signaling to you that I want to let go, and I want to refocus on seeking the real God, not making my own gods and resting on those. Then come forward, sit on the front, and do that. The words from the song we sang earlier were, still the greatest treasure remains for those who gladly choose you now. For those who gladly choose you now, the greatest treasure remains. So let's sing, pray. Come forward if you want someone to pray with you.